Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 103, recorded January 20th, 2011. You don't need to upgrade. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off the lifetime of your new account, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TWITCH.
Good evening, America, and welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton, joined, as always, by the man, the myth, the benchmarking legend himself, Mr. Ryan Shrout of PCPer.com. Ryan, how are you today?
I'm cold, and I'm tired of the snow, but that's about it. We're getting about 6 to 8 inches of snow here today. Hence, running a little bit behind, trying to go out to dinner and all that kind of stuff, making sure my wife got home a little bit more safely, that type of thing. But
we're going to have a high-speed show today, a streamlined, high-speed, low-drag show to enable Mr. Shrout to keep his wife from killing him in his sleep. I'd also like to apologize to everyone in Ohio for not having enough hills to take advantage of 8 inches of fresh powder. That's a little Ohio humor for people who've never driven across Ohio, which is very hilly compared to parts of Iowa.
If you drive from Cincinnati to Columbus, it's almost the most boring thing you can look at. It's like cornfields on either side, and it's just straight and flat. So
you've never driven across western Kansas into Colorado.
Kansas sounds worse, huh?
Ohio is awesome compared to Western Kansas, which probably should bring us to the show. Twitch at twit.tv. That's where we take your email questions. We love to have them. They help fuel the show. Huge week in technology news if you're into following technology management. Not so big if you're into tech, hardware, computer hardware. Ryan and I are on a self-imposed tablet strike at this point. If you want to learn more about tablets, Popular Mechanics has a fantastic roundup of approximately 30 tablets available running Android.
Are you kidding me?
Not round up, basically sort of a guide. I think somebody sat down and collated everything they saw at CES. I'll see if I can find the link to that. It's up on the front page of popmech.com. It's unhinged, to use a phrase I occasionally abuse. Let's see, popularmechanics.com. 30 tablets, huh?
Was this the iPad killer link?
No, although one of the other things they came up with is apparently the guys at one of the authors at Popular Mechanics realized that for $200,000 you can become your very own tablet vendor, which also would explain why we're seeing so many tablets from so many people we've never heard of. I'm just going to let Pop Mech run in the background until the tablet stuff shows up again.
Yeah, that's good.
Sorry, there's just so much. Popular Mechanics is a place I go to get lost. Let's talk about power supplies before I get distracted by popularmechanics.com again. If you do not know it, a lot of the errors we attribute to bad hard drives, bad operating systems, bad memories, or dying CPUs are actually the responsibility of poor power supplies. Power supplies that do not deliver current that is within, or I should say, voltage, amperage, power that is within the specs of your motherboard and CPU's requirement. It can lead to data loss, actually. A lot of unexplained data loss can be traced back to a cheap-ass power supply that came with your $30 case. And so your next step is like, I'm going to go buy an 850-watt power supply. That should be enough power for the rest of my natural life. Except it turns out a lot of power supplies cannot really deliver anything near the power printed on the side of the box. Which brings us to two articles from PCPer.com that came up lately, including one for a brace yourselves if you're looking in the four GPU power dual core i7, seven hard drives, and a fistful of God knows what stuffed in the case. 1200 watt power supply. Who needs a 1200 watt power supply?
Not very many people actually need a 1200 watt power supply. I mean, 1200 watts, I mean, you're right, that exactly targets four graphics cards. I'm looking at the kind of the connector layout that they have here. Besides your motherboard connectors, they've got the standard ATX, plus they've got dual 8-pin ATX power connectors. Those are useful for super high-end motherboards that have that. They have a total of eight 8-pin PCI Express power connections coming out of this power supply. Wow. So that is enough for four 8-pin graphics cards. Let me say that. Four graphics cards that require two dual 8-pin connections. So more than, hopefully more than anybody actually has that is listening to this. And then you can look at, there's like 22 Molex connectors. They even still have a floppy power connector, so that's good. A lot of SATA data connections or SATA power connections. The real benefit to going with a high quality power supply like this is not so much the wattage. You can, but what you get out of it is quality components. The stuff that you were getting into before, that it's not cheaply built. You're not getting it. Do they even sell power supplies that come with those cases still anymore? It's been so long since
we've had when you shop that. In the places I do, you can still buy a $40 case with a 300-400 watt power supply.
Okay. Well, it's a good recommendation to not use that power supply, just as a general rule of thumb, I guess. It was interesting to see the power supply revolution happen over, I'd say, like the past 4 years. Mm-hmm. 4 or 5 years ago, if you go back, there were only two or three power supply manufacturers that I would consider good quality. I remember PC Power and Cooling when they were their own small, much, much smaller company before they got bought by OCZ. They really made super expensive, super high power, high wattage, very nice power supplies. And there were a whole lot of ones that made really junky power supplies. There were only a handful. And then we saw this revolution where this happens a lot. It's very cyclical in the PC world, where somebody finds out that, hey, here's a high profit margin area that we haven't addressed yet. Let's go make some of those things. And in this case, you saw companies like Corsair, XFX, quite a few others, especially a lot of companies that had OEM brands started to create their own retail brands as well. And what we saw it do from our perspective was completely obliterate the kind of average quality that people expected from a power supply. Mm-hmm. And so we've seen this ramp up of power supplies where now most power supplies that you are buying at a retail environment that are of a brand that we have recognized are actually good. You know, there are still differences between them in terms of quality build, things like efficiency and AC ripple and noise levels on power lines and stuff like that. But in general, for those people not doing the super extreme stuff, the quality has increased quite a bit, as long as you're avoiding some of that really bottom of the barrel type of product.
I mean, at this point, if you're going out today, you're walking into the store, Antec comes to mind. And does PC Power and Cooling still exist, or are they basically under the OCZ brand these days?
They still exist, and they still have independent manufacturing and testing facilities compared to OCZ. What has happened is they brought some of the... They're using the OCZ brand to create a lower-cost version of that same power supply in many instances. So that way they could, you know, go into the lower markets, lower end markets, mid-range markets without kind of maybe blemishing the name of PC Power and Cooling, because that's a pretty high-end name when you think of power supply, right? And then also, you know, when they bought that, OCZ got a lot of the expertise of these guys who have done really good jobs on power supplies and have unique ways of testing and filtering out, you know, good and bad products and everything before they're manufactured. So, PC Power and Cooling is still a really good brand. They cater to a very specific type of user, that high-end enthusiast. We still use a lot of the PC Power and Cooling 1200-watt power supplies here. We had one for a while as our graphics card test bench. It was a 1200-watt turbo cool unit, but it had a small fan in it, and it was a large power supply, so the fan was very loud. And wanted to take noise testing levels of graphics cards, that was the first item that had to go. We ended up replacing it with a Corsair 1200-watt power supply. So, I mean, there are a lot of good options now. And in fact, if you look through some of the power supply reviews at PC Perspective or Hard OCP is another great place that they do a really good job with power supply reviews, you know, you'll see that there are still a lot of high-quality options out there. And they range anywhere from, you know, 350, 400 watts up to, I think we saw a thermal take at CES that is 1,475 watts, which you know, you talk about crazy, stupid power supplies, that would probably be the top list.
So Antec, Corsair, PC Power and Cooling, OCZ, all doing a pretty good job. How about Silverstone? That was one of the other ones you guys had up recently. The Silverstone Strider Plus 850 watt power supply.
Yeah, I mean, they're also still a quality brand. Mm-hmm. They haven't been as frequent in their iterations of a new mm-hmm. product. So that's kind
that's
of where
not necessarily a bad thing, by the way.
That's true. Because if you look at a company like Intermax, mm-hmm. Intermax hasn't, they don't release a lot of power supplies, but the power supplies they do release tend to be very high quality. And then because of that, they don't need to change them very often. And, you know, power supplies are not a very pretty product. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not kind of flashy most of the time. So even a company like OCZ that is usually very, very good at marketing finds it difficult to really push and sell a power supply unit as kind of being hot and sexy in the PC world. I mean, XFX came out with the power supply last year, I believe, that was like fluorescent green internals and stuff like that.
Right.
And it was a good quality unit, but it didn't do very well in sales. I mean, a power supply is a power supply. Most people aren't looking for flashy like that. So, but yeah,
I will say, like, I've seen some of the prettiest power supplies I've seen have turned out to be some of the most. This is 2 or 3 years ago. There were some people were kind of trying to, you know, like, oh, people, the kids like to put this water cooler with the antifreeze and the black lights and the posters inside their PCs with the windows. And they started doing some aesthetically, well, you know, a lot of orange and black and things that glowed in the dark. And it was amazing to see some of those, you know, basically turning into flames as soon as you put a serious load on top of them on a testing environment. But yeah, it's nice to see power supplies settling down into something consistently good.
There are, you know, there are debates that will rage probably until this show is well done and gone about, you know, people will talk about what is it, the modular power supply versus the directly connected cables and all that type of stuff. You know, in the end, almost anybody that doesn't have a financial interest in one or the other will tell you it doesn't really matter. For, you know, noise, ripple, current, all that kind of stuff. It's really
the modular cables could come use. How often do you throw your computer down on the floor? Because that's about what it's going to take to get the modular cables out of the average PC power supply.
Yeah, exactly. You know. And for me, for my money, modular cables in the back of a power supply just help me keep the inside of the case clean. And mm-hmm. I'm kind of a lazy PC builder. So any help I can get in that area is definitely welcome. Hence why I'm such a big fan of the Corsair Obsidian cases that have that really easy to use that you can't help but get it right cable management system for SATA cables and power and all that kind of stuff. So I appreciate the simplicity of some of those types of things, whereas some people just like to stick with what they know and cables that are permanently attached and et cetera, et cetera. And that's how it's going to be. So,
and so it was, and so it shall always be. Something odd came out this week, along with sort of CEO news, but a little more germane to what we do here on This Week in Computer Hardware. AMD, we like AMD. AMD does their job. It forces Intel to do a better job and processor prices, i.e. computer prices, stay low for all of us, at least until we're all running our lives on cell phones. The board of directors at AMD have decided to oust Chief Executive Officer Dirk Meyer. Which I think pretty much came out of the blue for everybody who watches the processor industry.
It did. And it was kind of, it was more of a surprise because Dirk had just been on stage at CES mm-hmm. unveiling, you know, the official launch of the AMD Fusion APU, the Brazos platform, the AMD E-series and C-series processors. And it was like 4 days later when he, quote, resigned, but pushed out, fired, however you actually want to call it. Mm-hmm. It was not something he probably wanted to do. And the kind of questionable, I guess, part about all this is that even he did a pretty good job. He hasn't CEO for very long, but he came in at a time when the company was being split off into two parts, when GlobalFoundries, the manufacturing portion of AMD, was split off into its own company and became GlobalFoundries, and that part was being purchased away. He successfully navigated through the settlement with Intel. You know, they got that $1.5 billion settlement last year as well, and now has launched the Fusion APU. Now, you know, he wasn't there for the entirety of all that. He wasn't the CEO, at least, for the entirety of all that, but he was there when it all happened. And they think basically the reason is that the board of directors, who, in case people don't realize it, is more powerful than the CEO. They have the ability to decide who's going to lead the company. Apparently, he and the board of directors had different ideals in the direction of the company. And that was kind of the line left hanging in the press release and that kind of stuff. Right. Nobody's quite 100% sure what that is. There's a couple of interesting theories. One, you look at what NVIDIA has done with Tegra, that they have partnered with ARM. They're now in the mobile cell phone space, that type of thing. And AMD doesn't have any direction. It doesn't have any current plans or ideas and directions in that way. So Intel has an option. It's not a very good one right now, but they're at least developing it. So one of the ideas is that he wasn't very keen on that mobile front, or he was being punished because he didn't foresee the movement into that mobile front like he should have. The other was the board of directors wanted to be purchased, like they wanted AMD to be purchased or to merge with another company. And he, as CEO, was going to stall that up, was going to stall that, because he didn't think that was the right direction for the company. So I like that second one a little more. It's a little bit more kind of like dirt, you know, getting dirt on people and that type of stuff. but it's interesting.
We have to dig for intrigue in the hardware community.
Yeah, you do. You really do kind of have to try hard, no doubt.
So I'm gonna use a quote here from Brian Klug over at AnandTech.com. It's a breath of fresh air to play with a real 16x10, 2560 by 1600 display after toying with 1080p monotony for so long. If the displays industry worked anything like the CPU industry, we'd have 300 pixel per inch displays with no response lag, infinite contrast, and all for way less than we're paying now. What are we talking about? Dell, the U3011, Dell's new 30-inch monitor. Which, if you are a monitor fan, which I am, I desperately want a 27-inch or larger monitor. You must. How many monitors are in the room you're in right now?
Ken, how many monitors do we have in the office? 22. There are 22 displays here.
That's even scarier than the number I had in my head.
We have a lot. We have, anyway.
Well, none of these monitors will be showing up in the Dell outlet for a very long time. We've mentioned this before. A great place to get a cheap price on a monitor is through the Dell outlet. A lot of times somebody buys a computer, decides they don't want it, ships it back, sometimes even without ever opening the box. Dell can't sell it as new. Or if they've opened the box, they can't sell it as new. And that's a great way to get a decent monitor for less money. The sort of high-end monitors, they don't get that many of them, so they don't bother to post them until they have a whole bunch of them stockpiled up. So I can pretty much guarantee you the U3011 is not going to show up at the Dell outlet for a very long time. This is a $1,349 monitor with possibly not the best contrast, but a decent-looking screen. I highly recommend you check out the U3011 review up on AnandTech.com. Yeah, if you want to see the future of your desktop, that should be trickling down to my desktop in a good 2-3 years. I'm still trying to get a 27-inch monitor.
It's disappointing to me that we're seeing new 30-inch monitors, but they're more expensive than the previous 30-inch monitors.
I think there's some, well, it's kind of the general thought I was getting, and I never have Robert Herron nearby when I need him, but the general thought I've been getting is that, you know, it's kind of funny, the reviewer Klug kind of refers to the tyranny of 1080p, right? Because we were having 1600 by 1200 monitors, and then all of a sudden it's 1600 by 1080, because computer monitors are competing with HDTVs for glass. And there are probably a lot more HDTVs being sold than computer monitors. I can hear the email burning up with a correction on that from somebody somewhere. But so when you end up with these super high resolution monitors, you know, it used to be that 1600 by 1080 would have been a big deal. Now it's every freaking HDTV from, you know, 24, 27 inches up through, you know, 56, 65 inches. And you have a finite amount of basically facilities turning out the glass. So I think what's happening is you need a super high resolution piece of glass to create these 30-inch 2500 by 1600 monitors, and they can only get so much time out of the factory. Excuse me, 2560 by 1600 pixel monitors. I think they're just competing, you know, for time and probably scarce resources to get the super high resolution monitors on that one. And I got to look. I'm up on the, I'm checking the availability and prices. 24-inch monitors are well under $200 now.
Yep.
Into the Dell Outlet monitor inventory live, ladies and gentlemen. This is why you watch Twitch. Exciting stuff. Yeah, nothing bigger than 24 inches on there. Rats.
Yeah, it's sad. And I know I am disappointed with the fact that 30-inch panels, and not necessarily 30-inch panels, but that resolution that we were kind of stuck at 1080p, or even if you can get a 1920 by 1200. Graphics card companies hate it more. Trust me. they are tired of only being able to sell you enough graphics card to power a 1080p display. They'd much rather sell you on 330-inch panels.
Right.
They can sell a lot more GPU horsepower that way. But, I mean, I'm looking, the refurbished 30-inch panel from Apple is $1,299. The cheapest I could find a 30-inch panel from Samsung on Amazon was like about $1,050, something like that.
Right.
And that's how much they've been for 4 years.
Mm-hmm. I just don't think there's enough demand in the marketplace to really push the price down. I mean, we're using 24-inch. We're moving most of the last of our desktops from 20 to 24-inch monitors here at work, right? Because three years ago, a 20-inch monitor was $250, and now a decent 24-inch monitor is around that $200 price level. Right. You can go to an ultra-sharp or one of the more sophisticated. Obviously, I'm not talking about like high-end television production monitors where you can spend $8,000, but... I'm just waiting for, you know, enough people to be like, I want the bigger desktop. I want more pixels. Cause I've decided I don't really enjoy working on a 46-inch computer desktop at 1080p. you know, the icons are really big, but it's the text is not so snappy. The text is just a little artifact filled and a little painful on the eyes. So hopefully
I was doing some testing with a wireless WHDI graphics card, this Galaxy one that I was talking about last week. Mm-hmm. And I have a 50-inch plasma. It's like literally sitting 3 feet from me, maybe not even that much, 2 feet from me running, you know. And I'm like, well, that text just isn't appealing looking, right? It's like, I need more. Right. If you're going to have 50 inches, you're going to need more pixels. It just makes sense.
Yeah.
Hopefully, what we need is 4K screens, Patrick.
Don't make me cry, man. Because then we need 4K content. No, this is true. And somewhere is going to be 1300 plus for a 2500 by 1600 pixel monitor. We need more pixels. Should we take an ad break?
How about before that? I was going to show you this little gadget. I think we talked about it last week, but did I show you this last week?
I was going to bring up that story. I thought that was hysterical. It's basically a... Oh, gosh, I can't think of who's making the card. I can't think of the company's name. Galaxy's making a wireless HDMI computer graphics card. So forget about HDMI. Now you're going to have 14 antennas sticking out of the back of your PC to power your HDTV. Or if you're a real, real freak, you could use it for your new 30-inch flat panel monitor. That's a lot of antennas.
It only does 1080p, so that would be a waste. But yeah, so we've got like five little antennas out here. We're literally finishing the article as soon as we get done recording this. It was pretty impressive. So you got that. That's the transmitter, obviously. And this is the receiver. Right. This is the little box that sits next to your TV.
That's
not 1080p, Blu-ray,
video. Does the picture disappear when you walk between the television and the graphics card?
No, actually, we had it about 40 feet apart, three walls between them. Not big concrete walls, but...
Mm-hmm. But walls. I mean, I've...
Interior walls.
I've seen a cat block some of the lower end wireless monitor products. So the idea of having three layer or three walls, which would be six layers of sheetrock and a bunch of 2x4s between the transmitter and the receiver, that's a big plus.
I was pretty impressed. Like we literally moved the TV to the exact opposite side of the building, which is about 40 feet away, and continued to watch Iron Man on Blu-ray and play some games. Obviously, a little more difficult without the keyboard and all that kind of stuff there, but it worked pretty well. And I had never. This is the WHDI standard, which was new to me learning about it. It uses the same spectrum as 802.11n, yeah. But it doesn't use those specifications. It creates something that it calls a video modem.
Is it running at 2.4 gigahertz then? Or is it running at 5 gigahertz?
I don't think so. It runs in the 5 gigahertz spectrum. But it treats data differently. They were saying their claim is up to 3 gigabits per second video streaming capability, less than 1 millisecond of latency. In our testing, it seemed accurate. You know, we moved the TV 40 feet away, through all the walls, lip sync, you know, playing the speakers out through the computer and that kind of stuff. Right. No issues there. Gaming with the mouse and keyboard, not an issue. Cool. It was pretty impressive. Expensive little card, but for like first-gen technology, works out pretty well.
What's the pricing on it?
$499.
Ah, that's not actually not as bad as I thought it was going to be. I mean,
my issue is that it's a GTX 460 graphic.
Got it.
So you're paying, a $300 premium for the wireless HDMI technology. So depending on how hardcore you are on your home theater PC goodness, that will determine whether or not it's valuable to you.
So it's fine for a home theater PC, not so fine if you are a bleeding edge gamer.
Right. Yeah, because even some of the newer games like Metro 2033, if you wanted to play that back at 1080p, you're not going to be able to hit maximum settings and that kind of stuff, which especially if you're talking about on a big TV, you want to make sure you have anti-aliasing turned up as high as you can and all the image quality settings as high as you can, since the pixels are bigger, physically bigger than on your 1080p monitor. So the better they look, the more, the better it will look, I guess.
Right. It is a good way, though. I mean, it's a really nice way. If you've got a Bluetooth remote or if you've got a way to wirelessly sort of string a wire to by your monitor, it's a really nice way to put your home theater PC in a closet far away from the rest of the living room.
Feature here.
There it is.
You can see on the back here, right? Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. That there's your HDMI output and then there's a USB port as well. Okay. And so what you can do is, so that this part plugs into the TV and you plug a keyboard or mouse up to that USB port. Mm-hmm. And then on the back of the graphics card, you will see a USB port as well, like a little mini USB port. So you plug, there comes with a little cable that plugs from that on the graphics card to a USB port on your motherboard.
Oh, I just became much more impressed with this card than I was.
So that way, transmitting a USB signal as well across that wireless spectrum.
Now I'm excited. Like, wireless video, 1080p, whatever, dude. But wireless video, 1080p, and I've got my remote for my Windows Home Media, my Windows Media Center PC. That's making me happy. I sense a home theater buildup in the near future on Techzilla.
Somebody asked in the chat room if it works in SLI, and this card does not have an SLI connector. So... Unfortunately, a good idea, but shot down already. So, how about we take our ad break now, and then we'll get into a handful of questions. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to all of you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. Squarespace.com, if you've never used it or ever heard of it, has an easy-to-use user interface for creating and managing a website or blog. I actually had one running on this for quite some time that was just a personal blog where I complained about things. Turns out nobody likes to read something complaining about things, but it happens. The good news about Squarespace is it's optimized for beginners and experts. So if you don't know anything about creating a web page, if you don't know anything about HTML or CSS, there's tons of templates in there. There's lots of ways for you to modify it easily, changing colors, moving components around, that type of thing. But if you are a CSS expert, you have complete control over the appearance of the website. You can start from scratch or you can start from a template edit from there, whichever's easier for you. Squarespace is an all-inclusive service that includes lots of modules to build your websites, like a blog module, forum, form builders, if you want to collect email addresses and other information from visitors, Flickr photo displays, Twitter widgets, Google Maps, and a lot more. Has website tracking, built-in search engine optimizing, so you don't have to worry about that type of stuff. Permission access handling, if you want to create like a tech hardware blog and you want to have multiple people having access to it, that's handy for that. It's built on a cloud architecture for speed and site stability, which basically means if you get on Dig or on Slashjaw, you don't have to worry about your site collapsing because of the infrastructure behind it. Squarespace has you covered there. It uses an innovative drag-and-drop Ajax interface. What that means is, if you don't like the fact that your latest news items are listed on the right-hand column of your site, you can go into the edit mode and drag it up above it, or drag it to the left side, or put it at the bottom. There's a lot of flexibility there to it. It has an iPhone app. So if you want a quick, easy way, not having to load up the full web page on your Safari browser and your and anything else on your iPhone, you can log on the website and update it on the go, which is really nice. So use Squarespace for all of your website needs. Build it, host it, and update it at any time. Now, for a free trial, all you have to do, sign up for a free account, squarespace.com. No credit card is needed. Try it out. Build the website. You get 2 weeks to play around with it, make it look how you want, get people to use it, look at it, and see what they think. And then if you decide to purchase it, if you use the offer code Twitch, that's T-W-I-C-H, you get 10% off of the lifetime of the account for as long as you're a customer of them. So that's squarespace.com, offer code Twitch, and we thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Woo-hoo.
On to some questions?
I think we should.
All right, let's do that.
Jesus has a question about a Sandy Bridge upgrade, and oh boy, do we get a lot of questions. Typical of this one. Hey, Ryan and Patrick, I love the show. I'm a huge fan. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. My question is, I was looking at the reviews for the new Sandy Bridge processors, and it got me thinking about upgrading, but I don't know if I should. And this is where basically everybody's like, is it time for me to upgrade yet?
Yeah.
He says, I use my PC mainly for gaming, music, and video conversion, and DVD and Blu-ray ripping. My current rig is, we're going to skip the case, the power supply. Very nice power supply, by the way. Motherboard, Asus P7, P55D, 8 gigabytes of G-Skill, an Intel Core i7-870 running at 2.93 gigahertz. And right there, I got to say, between that and the fact that he's already got an Intel X25M in there and a decent, not great video card, but a solid video card, I'm going to say right now, no, it is not time for you to upgrade. Would you disagree with that? I see Core i7 and I think, wait another year, man.
I agree. So a Core i7-870 is a really good part. He doesn't mention about any kind of overclocking. With that part, you could probably be able to get it up to almost 4 gigahertz on air cooling with pretty modest overclocking skills. And you've got a good ASUS motherboard that will be able to do that without much problem. Right. You've got 8 gigs of memory. You got a good SSD plus a Velociraptor plus your 2 terabyte hard drive and the GTX 460 graphics card. You got a pretty good system there. Now, depending on when he bought this, if he bought that as soon as the 870 came out, maybe he's just got that itchy finger buy button at Newegg or Amazon or something like that, you know?
If you think about it, this is a really nice high-end system because he's got his boot drive as an Intel X25 SSD, a 120 gigabyte one, which is not cheap. His gaming drive is a 300 gigabyte Velociraptor. His storage drive is a 2 terabyte Western Digital Black. My thought is like the 460 GTX, maybe add a second one and bump up the graphics performance, or maybe, right, if you really want to spend money, this would be a good time for you to personally try out the new 30-inch monitor from Dell and let us know how you like, 2560 by 1600 gaming. But man, a Core i, I just don't see a huge delta in performance between the new Sandy Bridge based processors and the Core i7 or even some of the Core i5 processors from last year or this year.
There are very specific instances of it, but if you're not doing a lot of video encoding or transcoding or something like that, then chances are you're not going to see a huge difference in gaming. He does say gaming, music, and video conversion. So there is an aspect to it that that the Sandy Bridge parts will definitely benefit him on. I agree.
But there's only two applications.
You're right.
You know, there's, you know, in 6 months from now, when there's like, you know, most of the major video applications or Handbrake or somebody else adopts the Sandy Bridge acceleration. But right now there's literally two applications that can take advantage of Sandy Bridge to accelerate your video encoding. And I just, you know, it's a nice chip. It's a great part, especially for building a home theater PC. If you don't need 23.97 whatever video playback built into the onboard graphics, because they still haven't figured that out with Sandy Bridge. So it's not quite the perfect home theater PC chipset yet. But right.
From what I hear, there is pending Handbrake changes that might take advantage of that. That's the rumor I'm hearing. I haven't seen anything yet. Intel won't show anything, neither will the guys from Handbrake, but that would be a pretty big deal if they can get that working. So
that would be pretty huge. But yeah, if you're looking for a dramatic performance increase, not an incremental performance increase, going from a Core i7 to one of the new Sandy Bridge parts is probably not going to blow your hair back.
Yep.
Philip's got a question about SLI on AMD chipsets.
Yep. So he asks, in the last show, or at least the last one I listened to, which would probably have been 2 ago, I guess, because I took this from last week, so we didn't get to it. There's an email regarding AMD chipsets and NVIDIA GPUs, possibly an SLI. And I think at the time we were talking about the fact that there weren't a lot of motherboards that would allow SLI as a option on them. He points us to a little project called, what is this called? It's kind of in Russian, so maybe I can't read it as well as I could anyway. That basically it tricks the NVIDIA driver into thinking you have an SLI-capable board. This sounds a bit sketchy, but it seems like it works pretty well from the research he's done, and in theory it makes sense. He started looking into this as an alternative to upgrading his MSI Cyclone GTS 450, which I got at a really good deal, basically on short-term card, for his Phenom 2 X6 processor. So the Project X Devs is what it's called. Says it's activating NVIDIA SLI in all motherboards. As always, it's like you're installing software that you found on the internet on your computer. It's modifying the driver, essentially. But it looks pretty simple from what the directions. You download the patch, put it in the same directory. You have to disable UAC, which as always, it's like, if they're telling you to disable that, you run the patch, it applies it to the driver, reboot, and boom, you're done. And all of a sudden, you'll have an SLI enabled system when you install that second graphics card. Works on 32-bit and 64-bit operating systems, and they even give you some uninstall directions there as well if you ever needed to undo it. Because have to reapply it for each time you install a driver. So.
I mean, what's the worst case scenario? You become a high performance server for a zombie botnet administered from incredibly talented Russian programmers who are taking advantage of all the power of your SLI system.
Yeah, exactly. They're just looking out for themselves. They want to make sure they have 2 GPUs per system to take advantage of the processing power. But you know what? To be perfectly honest, it doesn't surprise me that this exists. It doesn't surprise me that it's this easy because the NVIDIA SLI licensing scheme is really just a licensing scheme. It's just around for them to make a little bit of extra money. It's just around for SLI to seem like a premium brand when there's zero need for it technologically. So the fact that there's a software switch for it doesn't surprise me at all, I guess.
It's a small world after all here in technology.
Yep.
Ralph has questions about the Z68 chipset for Sandy Bridge. He says he just noticed the details are starting to leak out on Intel's Z68 chipset for socket 1155, aka the Sandy Bridge. It appears to combine the ability to overclock the CPU and run discrete graphics like the P67 with support for the integrated graphics / video processor like the H67, and in support for SSD caching via the rapid storage technology feature. And this looks like a total winner for enthusiasts. Is there something I'm missing aside from having to wait for it to actually come out and hit the market?
Based on everything that he's read that I am also reading, I think he's correct. And if you think about it, you know, when we talked about Sandy Bridge last week or the week before, my biggest complaint was that you had these K-series parts, 2500K and the 2600K. These are supposed to be AMD enthusiasts. They have unlocked multipliers on them. They are also the only desktop parts that offer the higher performance integrated graphics. This makes zero sense. Usually somebody who's going to have an overclocked system is going to have discrete graphics as well.
Right.
And when you use discrete graphics, it disables any ability you had to use the integrated graphics, either for secondary displays or the transcoding application, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So the rumors about this other chipset seem very plausible. It seems there are pictures out on the internet, and usually when we start seeing pictures of things, that tends to mean that they're for real. So Z68 is apparently the name for it. It will allow you to use video output from the integrated graphics, as well as still have the overclocking and PWM features of the P67 chipset, in basically a combination of the best of both worlds. I have no idea on a time frame for this, and most of the stuff that I'm looking at don't really say anything about any kind of time frame, and that to me says we're probably talking probably April, May, or June, sometime Q2. If it were going to be anytime really soon, I think I'd either know about it or had started hearing release dates from either motherboard manufacturers or Intel directly. So
you're going to have to wait, like the rest of us, Ralph. Raymond's got a question about AMD Fusion Power Supplies. Hi, Ryan and Patrick. Longtime listener, love the show. Thank you, Raymond. He says, I want to build an AMD Fusion desktop for my parents when hardware becomes available. It's actually out, I think, from Gigabyte and a couple other people. How many watts will a system like this draw? It will only have a hard drive in addition to the motherboard, CPU, and the RAM. I like small systems. Will AMD Fusion be available in a mini ITX format? He wants to install Windows 7 via USB. In fact, I am looking right now at a web page, and you are probably holding a Gigabyte E350N USB 3.
It's exactly that.
Is that even drawing 200 watts of power? I mean,
I bet fully loaded, if we're not using discrete graphics, it's probably going to use 30 watts.
Yeah, because I was actually surprised. It definitely is available in mini ITX format. I was surprised they didn't do a power supply input on the back next to the rest of the sockets. It does take a traditional ATX power supply socket down there on the motherboard. It's kind of hidden in all those components, which is kind of hard.
Now, you can buy, because actually AMD pointed me to a couple of these today, actually, little devices that plug into an ATX power connector, but then terminate and they ship with AC power adapters.
Oh, cool. Like a wall wart type adapter.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you send me that link? That would be really useful for something I'm playing with. That's actually, by the way, a really, really nice motherboard. A single PCI Express 16 slot.
Yep.
Gigabit Ethernet on board, which I guess everything has these days. Support for Dolby Home Theater built into the Realtek chipset. And
USB
look at
3
that
on there as well. SATA 6 gigabit per second. So it's a pretty robust solution in addition to being ultra low power. I mean, and the funny thing is the reason we got this email today about that is that AMD sent out a couple of these boards, an MSI and a Gigabyte, and they were concerned because the MSI board, this one, is using about 7 watts more power than the Gigabyte board. And that's a significant percentage. Of the total power consumption. So they're like, there's a BIOS tweak coming, but just so you know, if you see results from other platforms, you know, obviously it goes into whatever components each vendor uses on the board and all that kind of stuff to see the total power consumption. So in terms of the power supply, it's really hard. You know, look for what kind of ratings you're seeing in mini ITX cases. Because a lot of times when you get a mini ITX case, it will have a power supply with it because of their unique form factors. Chances are any power supply will power this without a problem.
Right.
You know, once you start putting a discrete graphics card in there, then you change the whole pretty dramatically. And you also kind of ruin the point of the whole platform because the processor in here, not meant for serious gaming. Probably pretty good at it. Not awful, but
pulling a high-end graphics card that sucks down 200 watts for a...
Here's an interesting idea, Patrick. See, now
you do realize somebody is going to do that. It's going to, you know, be a little bit bigger.
So this is a GTX 460, not super out of this world, but now you've got wireless HDMI coming out of it as well. So mini ITX, although it does kind of extend past the mini ITX form factor, I guess that way. So
I don't know, mini ITX. I don't know. If you want to have fun browsing for mini ITX cases, check out mini-itx.com. It's a great way to get your little tiny PC on. Never actually bought anything there, but I've spent hours wandering through their website. Thomas has an email about our failing hard disk drive. Well, email from last week. Regarding the failing 1.5 terabyte Seagate hard drive, around 2 years ago, Seagate shipped all of their 7200.11 drives with bad firmware that would shutter the platters every time the drive was spun down with the head still over the platters.
Goodness.
Pardon me, everyone.
Emergency.
I'm going to mute my microphone for a moment, lest we all have a terrible nose-blowing experience together.
No, all right. I don't think I need to explain why shaky platters near the head read head would be a bad thing, but I'm sure that's why the listener's drive is failing. If you Google Seagate SD15, you'll see what I mean. The good news is all of these drives came with a 3-year warranty and that all 72.11 drives are still in warranty since the first one came out less than 3 years ago. Seagate's online RMA is easy to use. It takes about 2 weeks total, so that's what he would do. I build computers professionally, and we got nailed by this. Hope this helps. Yes, it does help a lot, actually.
Thank you so much, Thomas. And that's why we love our audience, because they are smart, and there are many of you.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about triple head in Linux, or should we get you out the door before you are snowed in, missed your dinner with your wife, and are sleeping with the 22 monitors in the PC per offices?
That's a good idea. Well, let's do... one last email here from Matt, and then we'll get into announcing our contest winners, and then we'll get out of here. Matt says, so I was looking at buying a GT430, which is an NVIDIA graphics card, for my Myth TV computer and got really confused by the naming scheme of NVIDIA. Some people were claiming that the GT240 was outperforming the 430. But some were saying that the 430 is better for video and the 240 is better for gaming. In reading a review on Newegg, someone else had the same issue and pointed out NVIDIA's own website where they break it down for everybody. That at least they know there's a problem. Love the show and keep up the great work. So if we look at this link, this NVIDIA.com page, it's basically a table of graphics cards that you can buy today. And it lists everything from the GeForce GTX 580, which is their top of the line, all the way down to their business user, casual home PC user, down to the GeForce 8400 GS. They even give you like... Mm-hmm. relative graphics performance number, which is kind of cool. Starting at the bottom is 1X. The 8400 GS is 1X. GTX 580, 75X. So your gaming performance, this is actually good. If you have an 8400 GS in your system, you're like, I wonder how much relative graphics performance I would get. Well, apparently you would get 75 times better gaming on there.
Well, it's kind of funny that they start with 1X is the GeForce 8400 GS. Wow.
Yep. So in his particular instance, he points out the GT430 and the GT240. And in fact, the 240 is rated as better 18X versus 13X for relative graphics performance. But if you look at where we got the other thing. Oh, for video, it's the other way around. The 430 has the more advanced pure video support on it as well. So it's... an unfortunate naming scheme. And this happens when a company changes the model numbers for something. It seems like every other week anyway.
Right.
So there you go there. We'll put that link in the show notes. It's just so you can get an idea of maybe where your graphics card stands in this regard. It's actually, I've never seen that table before we sent that email in. It's just kind of handy to see everything in a list.
Unfortunately, I wish they
showed all the previous gen stuff that isn't for sale anymore, but
there's only so much you can ask for. I mean, I've had moments, you know, I find, you know, BMW's naming scheme Byzantine, but at least I know people who can explain it and understand it who are actually BMW purchasers. Outside of people who review cards for a living, I've never seen anyone completely master NVIDIA and ATI's naming schemes, especially, and it's kind of funny, is it's not nearly as bad as it was as 5 or 6 years ago when they kept doing like the Pro or the GTX or some other three-letter variation where you could have a higher number that actually performed less than a lower number card depending on which iteration of the chip was available. But yeah, that's very good chart, Matt. Thank you so much for sharing that.
All right. Now, I believe it was, I don't know, 4 months ago or something, we were giving away contests. Always, it was just our 100th episode, so it wasn't that far away. A two high-end ASUS server-class motherboards. I think they're sitting here. They're not sitting here, but you remember them, especially if you entered the contest. One of them was like a $400 motherboard that had like 6 PCI Express by 16 slots in it. Mm-hmm. Really, really good stuff here. So our winners The first of which, I will give them the option to pick which of the boards they want. Because one's 1366, one's 1156, so they want to go one way or the other. Is the first winner was Jesse Parks. And I believe I asked them to tell us what their favorite, or what they're most looking forward to seeing in 2011 in terms of tech. The response was, the top tech I'm looking forward are the AMD Fusion chips will hopefully kick Atom to the curb and the rest of the desktop level offerings from AMD as Intel. Or he wants to see the rest of the desktop level offerings from AMD and Intel in the new year. So AMD Fusion chips, obviously we talked about those. Mm-hmm. You will get to see those in the new year. The second place winner who will get whatever the first place winner does not take was Corey Hendricks. And he said he's really looking forward to CES and anything new that will just blow me away. I really hope to someday purchase an iPad because it's a really cool and fun gadget to have and play with. Loves the podcast. Keep up the great work. So hopefully, Corey, there was a lot of stuff at CES that blew you away. Hopefully you like tablets.
Especially Android and Windows 7 tablets. I still can't believe they sold 7 million iPads in the first quarter of 2011. Basically the 2010 Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa shopping season. 7 million iPads. That is a lot of iPads, people. Apple made a lot of money this quarter. Wow. Well, I'm Patrick Norton. You can find me at techzilla.com, T-E-K-Z-I-L-L-A. What's coming up on PCper.com in the next couple of weeks? Outside, of course, of the fantastic Galaxy. Yeah, it's Galaxy WHDI is the spec, but what's the Galaxy part number on that
one? It's the Galaxy GTX 460 WHDI. So it leaves open for more WHDI accessories down the road just by adding that name to it. we also have a ton of mini ITX motherboards, both Fusion, H67 for the new Sandy Bridge platforms. We are working on some new SSD goodies coming out, hopefully next week as well, early next week. Some new SATA 6 gigabit per second SSDs, which should be pretty cool. Hopefully will be a lot of stuff up between now and the next time we talk, hopefully. All depends on how fast we get this train rolling, so...
And whether or not you get snowed in the office.
I'd be Twitch. More productive that way, wouldn't I?
Yeah, but you'd never be able to go home again. Like, see if you don't. Hey, Dad, I'm trying to make humor and it's failing miserably. So I'm going to say that's it for this episode of Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Trout.
We'll see you next week.